Ambrose knew many people in Hollywood involved in creating special effects, and the sounds, he said, was something none of them could have conceived. How would you duplicate that sound? He asked. I'm not just talking about how it sounded to your ears, but how do you show those various things on a spectrum analyzer and on the scope that it was doing? It's one thing to make something that sounds like it, it's another thing to make something that sounds like it and has those consistent and random oscillations in it. If it is a hoax, he continued, I'd like to meet the guy who did it, because he could probably make a lot of money in special effects. See, since the spring of 1977, the farm had been slowly transformed into a functional place complete with electricity and hot and cold running water. Finally the mud was gone. The water that had once spilled down the hillsides was now dammed, directed, and fashioned into small pools. Running in long, well-tended rows, a huge garden spread from the old carriage house along the path to Schmidruti. Pear and apple trees produced large fruit in the fall and provided fresh juices kept on the back porch in large glass jugs. At the entrance to the farmhouse, screen mesh covered the large aviary filled with canaries and finches, one snow white, fluttering back and forth between nests made of little baskets. From the front porch came a constant chirping and twittering. But one thing at the farm had not changed. It continued to attract large numbers of strangers, the religious, the scientific, the philosophical, the cynical, the merely curious, all wanting to speak with Mia. Families came, as well as priests, ufologists, film crews, couples on motorcycles, single women, reporters, and an occasional disciple searching for the Messiah. At dinner the Mia kitchen often filled with people they had never seen before, and because of Samjay's request that he educate Earth humans on the existence of other races in the universe, Mia felt obligated to speak to them all. In November 1978, after a dozen or more articles about Mia had appeared in the European press, Der Spiegel, the huge international magazine, had run an 11-page cover story on UFOs, apparition or reality. The UFOs come. The magazine cover was a dramatic Mia photograph, a beam ship accompanied by a remote-controlled craft, the latter just below the horizon. The people who now sought out Mia came from all over the world. An old guest book signed by only a very few of the visitors bore addresses from Tahiti, Japan, France, Germany, Spain, Italy, Mexico, and Belgium. Actress Shirley MacLaine flew to Switzerland to spend 5 days with Mia, helping to weed the garden and trim tree branches by day, and at night probing Mia for answers about the universe. When MacLaine left, she signed the guest book, To Billy and His Loving Fight for All. Thank you for your dedication, your patience, and your love. Always shine. Shirley. Pope I remained disgusted with the visitors. I was fed up many times, she said later, but we didn't have a choice. They would come into my house and say, okay Billy, let's go. Not a word to me. I got aggressive, I could not see why people could not understand when I told them that Billy was busy right now. They came here with their problems and Billy had to be here no matter what. He didn't care about his health, and the people didn't see that he needed time to relax, to take care of himself, and to be my husband. Nobody ever asked Billy, so you have a problem? Can we help you with anything? I learned to accept the way it is. Von Daniken came. He wanted information. Billy talked to him. I was glad that I didn't have to speak with these famous people. We were there, recalled Lee Elders, when cars came in from France, Holland, Denmark, from all over Europe. It created a nightmare for him. At the very beginning, added Britt, Billy sincerely questioned his sanity. Why me? Why here? Why now? Then he got to where it became fun. All of these people he'd never met before, coming to talk to him. Then the photographs hit the magazines, and all of a sudden he was swamped with people. They started lining up outside. Literally lining up. And that he didn't enjoy. People would say, give me this photograph. Or let me have that photograph, then they would disappear and he would never see them again. Here I think all of the fun left it, because half of everything got stolen. The kids were being harassed in school. His wife was unhappy, and he wasn't real happy. Because there was a constant flow of human bodies. Always. Popeye still would have nothing to do with any aspect of the contacts. She refused even to discuss them with her husband. Popeye was very jealous of the contacts anyway, said Britt, not just the fact it was with a female space traveler, but also that Billy was doing something she couldn't be a part of, and that she, deep down inside, didn't want to be a part of. She didn't want anything to do with the contacts, she didn't want to know what was being said, she didn't want to see the photographs. And she didn't want to talk to the people who were invading her privacy. I've seen her take on everybody in the kitchen, tell them to get out, leave the house, go away. She never wants to see them again. Because they were making demands on her husband, and in her mind that was separating her husband from her. She finally got to the point where she didn't care. She didn't care if anybody showed up, she didn't care if her house was a mess. She didn't care what happened to her kids, herself, or her husband. Everything around her was overrun with strangers. Mia predictably had become a cult figure, visited by individuals searching for something to give life meaning. Some of those who had gravitated to him looking for an answer even took up residence at the farm, as rooms were completed and outbuildings renovated. They always wanted more contacts, notes, and photographs. The new people helped keep the farm going and assisted Mia in printing his contact notes, but now he spent much of his time and energy settling disputes among his followers. Women frequently clashed with Popeye, and men vied to become Mia's confidant. Even the contact notes had acquired a decidedly terrestrial tone, often concerned merely with the problems and personalities inhabiting the farm, and attributing conflict among the members to the acts of dark forces called the Geyser people. The warm and stimulating, even magical atmosphere that many had experienced in Mia's presence began to erode with the arrival of more and more people. Finally, rules had to be drawn, work schedules enforced, and dues collected from those who lived at the farm, as well as from regular visitors. Everyone remaining at the farm longer than 30 minutes was expected to work. And if anyone wanted to speak with Mia, they either had to do so in the field as they worked next to him or in the kitchen after they had earned a piece of his time. In the fall of 1979, with a Japanese production crew from the Nippon Television Network Corporation waiting in London, the elders had traveled ahead to Shimadzuchi to see if Mia would agree to being interviewed for a documentary on his experiences. But when they arrived at the farm, they found Mia locked in his office, not speaking to anyone. He wouldn't come out of his office, Lee elders remembered. He wasn't eating. They would take a tray of food to the door and it would sit there. All he wanted was his cup of coffee and his cigarettes and leave me alone. For 3 days Mia remained alone in the small room he used for an office. When he finally broke silence, it was to send an urgent summons to elders. What an experience that was. I'll never forget it as long as I live. I walked in, the room was dark, there was one little lamp on, and he was sitting there, in the chair. We were about this far apart. And the light was on my side. I couldn't see him fully, but he could see me. His hair was wild and he had this wild look in his eyes, and he would just sit there. I mean, he was just a beaten man, totally withdrawn, staring at me. Somewhere along in my life I was told that the first man that speaks under conditions like that loses. So I thought, I'll wait him out. I went through 3 cigarettes. Nothing. Him staring at me, and me looking at him and smoking a cigarette and waiting and waiting. Finally I knew he wasn't going to say anything, and I could have been there all day, so I said, "How are you, Billy?" And he goes, "Oh, Lee." And then he poured his heart out to me for 2 hours, talked and talked and talked about problems on the farm and how the pressure was getting to him, and he couldn't go on anymore and he was going to break the contacts. He says, "I will break them. Break them." He kept talking. So I sit for 2 hours in this darkened room listening to him, and finally I said, "How about some tea?" So I got up, went to the kitchen, got some tea, then went back over. I was there 6 hours total with the man. I did everything in my power to convince him to continue what he was doing. I'll never forget. It sounded hokey at the time, but in a way, when I started thinking about it, it wasn't that hokey because it worked. I drew the analogy of Michelangelo. I said, "Look, Billy, you're familiar with Michelangelo, aren't you?" He nods. "Well, look at this man, look what he created, look what he did while he was on this planet, look at his artwork, look at the things that he accomplished, look at what he gave to humanity. You're doing the same thing. Your photographs are like Michelangelo, they're the best anybody's ever seen." I said, "You're contributing to raising the consciousness on this planet, and that's very important." I went on and on. And he started listening, and then he started thinking about it. His problems were minute because he was accomplishing something great. See, by that time we had gone through a period where people were hounding us day and night over volume I, letters from kids and letters from doctors and letters from people with terminal illnesses trying to get to the Pleiadians for help. We had undergone this onslaught of individuals. There was meaning behind it to them, and they weren't UFO nuts. It was sort of like hope during troubled times. So I knew what he was going through, but I also knew what it meant to these other people. Finally I said, "Billy, I've got some Japanese waiting in London, what'll I tell them?" And he says, "Bring them in." While they waited for the film crew to arrive, Britt continued to record everyday life at the farm in her diary. Popeye fixed 3-minute eggs, bread, sausage, cheese, enough for an army. Last night we had potatoes and cheese. They laughed at us because we ate the potato skins, they peeled theirs. I'm going to teach Popeye how to fry eggs, make omelets and sausage the US way. One night 8 people piled into a Land Rover, and Mia drove on back trails across meadows to a small guesthouse restaurant. "Billy drives like a madman," wrote Britt, "lights off, shifts with his foot, laughs all the time, says he's protected, don't worry." At the restaurant Lee had his first coffee-ish, we all joined in, had coffee-ish, coffee schnapps. Came home same way, no lights, Billy shifting with his foot, don't worry, we're protected. Back home after a jigger of the strongest rum anyone could ever make, we all felt extremely relaxed. Billy asked if we had ever seen this done before, and at that point he threw a spoon across the table and when I picked it up it was bent, twisted. Then he did one for Lee. After Mia had bent the spoons, Britt said, "Are you the next so-called prophet?" "No," said Mia. "All people are prophets, and everyone has the power to bend spoons." Mia explained that Bi used the force from the people around him and the force of his own mind in channeling it. "I call them foolish turnarounds," he said. Then he held up one of the spoons he had bent. "This I do only for Britt." And between his thumb and index finger, Britt wrote in her diary, "He melted the spoon and broke it in half." Lee still watched Mia closely, searching for a weak point or a clue. But Mia was so quick and so natural, elders had yet to see anything suspicious or revealing. "I was fascinated with what he could do with a nail," said elders, "with what he could do with a compass making it spin around without touching it. He'd say, it's just power of the mind, so he didn't equate it to his Pleiadian contacts. It was something he had learned perhaps years ago, perhaps in India. But this fascinated me, because at this point I was pretty well convinced in my own mind that he was not hoaxing this thing through normal means." Ichinichi and the Japanese production crew arrived in Shimizuji the latter part of September to begin 3 weeks of filming. Their first night at the farm, they sat in the living room watching and filming Mia's 8mm footage of the beam ships off a white screen. In the first sequence the ship darted back and forth over a farmhouse and a tall pine tree, and then appeared to cut quickly in front of the tree as the top branches suddenly bent as if caught in a backwash. Talking excitedly in Japanese, the crew had Mia run the sequence over and over as they focused on the top branches of the tree. Then while watching another series filmed at Hasenbol, one of the crew members noticed something unusual about a seeming reflection off the ship's flange. Mia ran it back, and the Japanese cameraman zoomed to the edge of the ship. There on the silver rim, like the slow brightening of a lighthouse beacon, a distinct red light flashed on and then off again. During the day, elders and Welcher accompanied the film crew to the sites where Mia's alleged contacts had taken place. They both had surmised for some time that if Mia's story were true, each of the landing sites would have some degree of radiation left behind by the beam ship. The proper instrument at the right sensitivity might be able to detect that radiation. After several phone calls, they located a gamma radiation detector at Wild Hebrag, a precision instruments company in Switzerland. Similar to a Geiger counter, the instrument measures electromagnetic radiation, and Welch spoke to a physicist there who had used it many times. "I told him what we were trying to determine," said Welch, "and he indicated that this would be the equipment to use." The physicist told Welch that the instrument would detect any artificially caused change in the molecular structure of grass and soil. While the crew filmed Mia in a meadow not far from Hinwil, where Mia claimed the first Pleiadian beam ship had landed and remained for an hour and a quarter nearly 5 years earlier, elders and Welch set up the radiation detector. To establish a comparison, they first took readings in the grass of the surrounding area, which measured a low 0.00 to 0.05. Each time a stronger reading appeared on the dial, they marked the spot on the ground. But before they had finished taking readings in all of the areas, they noticed that the spots marked on the ground were beginning to form roughly the shape of a circle. Inside the circle, the radiation level consistently measured 0.2, roughly 400% higher than the background measurements. And the readings inside the circle pulsated. "It didn't go up and hang," remembered Welch. "It went up like this and then down a little bit, and then went back up, back down a little bit. We didn't expect this." In diameter, the circle in which the readings pulsated and the radiation rose so much higher measured roughly 21 feet. According to Welch's notes taken at the time of the measuring, "Immediately after that we went back to the hotel and I contacted the physicist who provided the equipment to determine if there was any significance at all to the findings, or if it was a calibration of the equipment that needed to be done." The physicist, who was somewhat reserved in his personality and approach, was surprised. "Tell me again the background readings," said the physicist. "Welch read them over the phone." "And the other readings?" asked the physicist. 1.5, up to 2.0, said Welch. "Where did you find these readings?" "Specifically." As nearly as he could describe the area, Welch told the physicist its location. The physicist then told Welch that he and others had been using the equipment in his laboratory and in the field for about 10 years, and it had always read accurately. No brand name appeared on the equipment, and the physicist could not remember its manufacturer. When Welch suggested that either the readings were insignificant or the equipment needed calibration, the physicist dismissed both possibilities. The equipment was sound and the readings were indeed significant, since they represented gamma radiation levels of between 100 and 400% above the highest background levels. The physicist recommended they immediately contact the Swiss Nuclear Safety Commission for further information and guidance, and allow their team to investigate. He did not know what the readings indicated, but he felt that a specialist should take them again and analyze them. He did not go into further detail, read Welch's notes, except to explain what would be required to cause any such gamma radiation detection: an unnatural source strong enough to change the electromagnetic nature of every molecule where the readings were obtained. Like a paper clip that has been magnetized, articles near a strong electromagnetic field would acquire a memory of that force. After this experience, they took the instrument to the Mia farm and got 0.00 readings in the vicinity, until they got within 400 yards of the house, a giant circle. Within the circle, the needle suddenly jumped from 0.00 to 0.15. "But it wasn't consistent," said Welch. "You'd be walking and there'd be no reading, and all of a sudden you would get this jump. And it would hang at 0.15 for a second, and then it would start to go down." At one alleged landing site at the edge of the forest below the farm, Welch again got sporadic readings up to 0.15. At another landing site in the gravel road leading to the front of the house, he got lightly pulsating readings from 0.05 all the way up to 0.2. At this point they decided to check all of the articles Mia carried to the contacts. They went into Mia's office and got his gun. First they took out the bullets and got no reading on those. When they asked Mia how long he had had the bullets, he said they had been purchased only recently. On the gun the meter went to 0.01. Mia's watch registered 0.05. A metal charm Mia kept in his pocket registered 0.1. While checking the objects, they discovered that Mia himself gave off readings. His left shoulder fluctuated from 0.1 to 0.15, and his right arm from 0.05 to 0.1. Welch again called the physicist at Wildhearburg. "Did you slam a door on it?" asked the physicist. "Did you crush it, or anything like that?" "Absolutely not," said Welch. "Is it something you have to handle like a feather? Because if that's the case, maybe a slight bump when you're picking it up out of its case could knock it off." "No," said the physicist, "it's not like that. That's a steel plate you're hitting." So at this point, Welch remembered later, "I was very intrigued." He didn't have any answers. And we sure as hell did not want to go to the Swiss Nuclear Safety Commission. After obtaining the unusual readings, Welch experimented with the instrument for a few days before they had to return it. He turned it on in his hotel room, while they were in restaurants, in open fields and forests, but each time, he recorded nothing near the readings he had gotten at the sites, at the farm, on the small articles, and on Mia himself. F. Herbert Runkle rarely came to the farm now. Whereas the Hill House had been a place of intellectual freedom, and the farm in the early days a joy to help rebuild, the new religious feel of the group with their enforced meditation and their regulations had stifled what remained of that earlier atmosphere. Mia had disenchanted Herbert 2 years earlier when he produced a series of photographs he said resulted from time travel with some Jays. The pictures showed the rubble of San Francisco following a massive earthquake that would occur sometime in the future. Later, a friend of Herbert's discovered an article in Geo magazine that showed an artist's conception of what the long-predicted catastrophe might do to the city, and Mia's photographs obviously had been taken of this lifelike painting. With all of the beautiful photographs that no one seemed able to duplicate or explain, Herbert had been unable to understand why Mia would resort to such an obvious fabrication. Mia had said that the Pleiadians simply placed in the artist's mind an accurate picture of the real future, the same one Mia had photographed. And then the photographs had disappeared. The pictures of San Francisco had confused Herbert because he had seen so many things for himself, some trivial, some remarkable, that contributed to a fascinating story he still could not explain. One October afternoon after he had been interviewed by the Japanese and they had departed, Herbert wanted to show Lealdas a site that long ago had particularly intrigued him. He drove to the site, one that he and Harold had once visited with Mia shortly after Mia had had a contact there. Herbert stopped the car in a field crossed by railroad tracks, where he and Elders got out and walked down a dirt trail into the forest. After about a quarter of a mile they came to a secluded clearing the size of 4 or 5 football fields and surrounded by fir trees 100 feet tall. A short way in from the meadow 2 trees in the forest bore large wounds frozen in sap and black from singeing. Herbert told Elders that on the day he and Harold had come to the site with Mia 3 years earlier, they had wanted specifically to see these 2 trees. Mia allegedly had shot them with a laser gun the Pleiadians had demonstrated to him. And when Herbert and Harold had looked at the 2 trees that Herbert now pointed out to Elders, they could not figure out how Mia had created these marks that ate through the thick tree bark unless maybe he had used some kind of laser gun. That day, while Herbert and Harold were studying the 2 trees, sometimes up close, sometimes stepping away to check distances, Mia had gone off nearby to look for mushrooms. At the edge of the clearing rambled a thicket of waist-high bushes. As he stepped all the way back to the meadow to eye one of the trees, Harold spotted from the corner of his eye a twig on a small bush. Something had snapped it in two. Something also had charred both of the broken tips. When Harold bent to examine the twig, he saw another one broken a few inches from the first. It, too, was charred. He called Herbert over and they discovered a perfectly straight line of broken twigs, each of them charred, that went through the tangle of thin branches, bush after bush after bush. It looked as though a narrow beam of intense heat had shot through the thicket. Harold had called to Mia, who came over with his mushrooms to look at the small broken branches. After examining them for a moment, he said he remembered aiming the laser gun at the two tall pine trees, but not in the direction of the bushes. Maybe he had, he couldn't remember. 3 years later the charred branches no longer could be found, but Herbert had pictures of them he showed to elders. The straight line that ran through the bushes, Herbert estimated, continued for at least 100 feet. Later in Munich, elders also questioned Harold about the incident and Harold told him, "You could recognize the line of fire by the cracked branches and the blackened tips. It was so thin you could not do it with a welder." At the site elders had seen immediately that a bullet fired through the bushes would not leave the branch tips so finely charred, and the painstaking use of matches could not be carried out in a straight line. What mystified elders even more was why Mia would go to so much trouble to fabricate such intricate evidence, when it seemed highly doubtful anyone would ever see it. The trip that afternoon with Herbert typified how elders and Welch spent most of their time in Switzerland, stumbling further and further into the unexplainable. The discovery of the charred twigs offered little concrete evidence that Mia's alleged contacts had taken place, but they were one more item on Welch's list of gross consistencies. While the elders and Welch were in Switzerland, Stevens and Dilettoso traveled to Pasadena to meet with Dr. Nathan at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Since Nathan could not work from the prints Stevens had showed to him, he had instructed Bob Post at the photo lab to have 4x5 color film positives made from Stevens's internegatives. These copies then would be digitized and the information stored in a computer where Nathan could analyze it later. Post asked an English woman, Audrey Adkins, who had worked in the photo lab almost as long as he had, to remain after work to process the transparencies, and Stevens instructed her not to discard any of her test strips or rejected copies. But when Adkins retired to the darkroom, placed the first internegative in the enlarger, and brought the actual grain in the film into perfect focus with a 20x microscope, the picture itself remained blurred. As Adkins brought each of the internegatives into the finest focus possible, she thought to herself, if Dr. Nathan can make anything of these, he's lucky. Both Post and Adkins skipped dinner that night to work on transferring the Mia photos from the internegatives to positive transparency film. After Adkins had finished her work around 7, she handed Stevens a large padded envelope and said to him, "This is all trash." She left the copies she had just made for Dr. Nathan. The new transparencies revealed that Stevens's internegatives were several generations away from the originals. In fact, they appeared to be so inferior to the beautiful prints Stevens had shown him at the outset that Nathan immediately suspected Stevens of using him, of deliberately offering evidence that could not be tested. "All I know is the negatives he gave us to work with were already out of focus and that's all he would let us have," said Nathan. "They had to be a different, later generation, or a generation specifically made that was intentionally out of focus. They couldn't have been used to make the very high-resolution prints he flashed by me. He was not giving me his best data, he wasn't showing me anything that I could work with." The key problem here, recalled Lee Elders, was a problem that originated with Mia himself. Because there had been so much theft of the original material, we didn't know if we had originals. If we had had the originals going in, it would have made life much easier for us. But we didn't. We knew we had a negative, but we didn't know how far down it was. Is it first generation, fifth generation? Nathan placed the new negatives in a drawer and never looked at them again. "I was never impressed with the pictures," he said. "I was very unhappy with them. At no time was I ever of the feeling they were anything but a hoax. But don't forget, all of my examination on this was extremely cursory. These things have not really been given a good examination because it isn't worth the time, from the quality of the images given us, to do anything. I have no proof that this is a fraud. But I have no proof that it is real. That's the second statement that should always accompany the first. For some time, Lee Elders had been trying to track down a key witness, Martin Sodge.